We are the Association for Child and Adolescent Mental Health, or ACAM for short. And this is ACAM Learn.
Welcome to Mind the Kids podcast. What does it mean for children when trauma ripples through generations? And how can social support create hope for better outcomes? This episode is called Breaking the Cycle, Prenatal Substance Misuse. Prenatal exposure to substances such as alcohol, tobacco and cocaine might not sound like the cheeriest of topics, but today's guest frames her research, featured in JCPP, in a powerful and uplifting way, offering real hope to those affected. I'm Mark Tebbs, I'm your host for today. I've kind of spent my whole career working in mental health, from frontline service delivery to director of mental health commissioning. I'm currently a chief executive of a charity. I'm a trustee for another mental health organisation. I'm a career coach, and I'm delighted to be hosting these podcasts because we get to speak to clinicians and academics at the forefront of children and young people's mental health. Today, I'm joined by Dr. Mi-Yong Min, Associate Professor of the University of Utah. Mi-Yong has spent her career unravelling how a child's own childhood maltreatment and prenatal substance misuse, especially cocaine during the 1990s epidemic, shape child development over time. Maternal trauma fuels psychological distress and harsher parenting, rippling into the child's own emotional and acting out behaviours, while prenatal exposure independently rewires stress responses in the brain, heightening risks. But social support and early intervention offers real hope to kind of break that cycle. So let's get started. Mi-Yong, really lovely to be speaking to you today.
Thank you. Thank you.
Great. Let's start with some introductions. So it'd be great if you could introduce yourself, maybe say a little bit about your research interests, and if there's anybody that you collaborated with on the paper you'd like to give a name check to, then here's your opportunity.
Great. I'm Dr. Mi-Yong Min. I'm Associate Professor and Bell Spafford Endowed Chair of College of Social Work at the University of Utah in Salt Lake City in the U.S. My research area is substance using mothers and their children. And my wonderful long-time colleagues, both Drs. Lynn Singer and Sonia Minnis, are professors from Case Western Reserve University in Cleveland, Ohio. And two other people who collaborated on this work is Dr. Junyoung Kim, who is assistant professor at the University of North Dakota. And Loja Kim is fourth year doctoral student at the University of Utah working with me.
Let's start at the beginning. So I'd be really interested to hear what kind of drew you to this area of research. Why were you particularly interested in mother's own childhood experience and what impact that had on child development?
I'm very interested in various biological and interpersonal and ecological factors shaping human development, especially for children and adolescents. So after spending some years studying and documenting the pervasive and very negative impact of childhood maltreatment across multiple domains of mental and physical health, it was just so natural for me to ask, what happens to the next generation? I kept wondering, how do these experiences echo through families? That question really drove me to extend the scope of the investigation to the next generation.
So many listeners will be familiar with the impact of childhood or maternal trauma on childhood development. Before, it'd be really useful just to kind of give a little bit of a background in terms of before this study, what was known about that kind of intergenerational transmission of kind of trauma?
So most study really focused on maternal psychological functioning, such as psychological distress and parenting behavior, as a main mechanism connecting mother's childhood trauma and their own child behavior problem, which makes sense given that importance of mother's influence on children. What we found somewhat missing is that a few studies examined the intergenerational impact of maternal childhood maltreatment in the context of prenatal substance use. Because we know, right, and multiple studies also showing that there is a strong relationship between childhood maltreatment and subsequent substance use. So we really want to connect this thought, our study, because of very relatively large sample size with developmentally appropriate measures across, in this case, 12 years of study. It provides very rare ability to look into complex intergenerational effects.
Okay, so were you seeing whether substance abuse was the kind of mediating kind of factor between trauma and then childhood outcomes?
So that was, I think that was our original hypothesis, and that was our original motivation. But in our study, no, it was not. The prenatal substance exposure is related to child behavior symptoms, especially externalizing behavior, but not through mother's trauma or mother's kind of adulthood maltreatment. So it is kind of independent risk process.
Okay, right, yeah. Okay, so look, let's get into this into more detail then. So you it was a longitudinal study. You followed families for a kind of decade. So could you describe how you went about the kind of methodology?
So I was lucky to involve with a really very well-established team focusing on mother's abuse during pregnancy and how that impact child development over time. So these children are recruited due to mom, right? So this study sample, we have about 400, but for this particular study, it's about 300. First mother and child diet. And as I said, it recruited mother from hospital when they come to hospital to deliver. And it is Midwest USA and also urban teaching hospital. So they were recruited originally for a study to look at the developmental effects of prenatal cocaine exposure at the time in US. Cocaine was really big issue. It's like opioid endemic. So a lot of people are nervous about what is their outcome. So that is the kind of part of kind of historical motivation at the time. And this study sample are primarily Black and very poor, getting public assistance. And about 40% of mothers didn't finish high school. And the issue is that the incidence of child maltreatment tended to be higher in substance-using women. So this is very good sample to test, to study intergenerational transmission of maternal childhood maltreatment and the potential role, right, possible role of prenatal substance exposure to extend our understanding about child psychopathology.
Okay. And did you just kind of, was it mainly focused around cocaine use, or were there other kind of like drug uses that you were studying?
Well, that's a great question. No, we usually that when women use cocaine, they use other drugs too, like alcohol, marijuana, tobacco. So a lot of times, most times, cocaine users are poly drug users. So we collected data on alcohol, marijuana, tobacco too. And also we collected like months prior to pregnancy and, each trimester, first, second, third trimester, and kind of ask about their amount and frequency of use and even the money they spend. And also for cocaine, we used meconium, which is babies first tool to detect mother's cocaine use.
So you mentioned it was a longitudinal study and you kind of followed the families over a long period of time. So could you kind of describe the kind of sequence of the research?
Oh, yes. When so we recruited women, right, the mothers, when they come to a hospital to deliver. And there we kind of collected the mother's urine and infant urine and the meconium. And then about a month later, we invite them to come to university-based lab. So that's about, the child became about a month old. So at the time, we collected the mother's drug use like alcohol, marijuana, and tobacco use. And then around 4 years visit, we asked mothers about their own childhood maltreatment experience. So sexual abuse, physical abuse, emotional abuse, and physical neglect and emotional neglect. And when the child become around 10 years, the mothers also reported their psychological distress, so mental symptoms, and also their parenting practice, which more involving some kind of maltreating practice, like shouting, hitting, that kind of. And then when child turned 12, which is really early beginning of adolescence, we asked both mothers and child about the child behavior symptoms. So when we say that behavior symptoms, we can say that there's two types of symptoms. One is internalizing, which kind of refer to depressive symptoms, anxiety, and psychosomatic symptoms. And externalizing behavior is more like aggressive behavior, acting out behavior. So we ask those things to both mothers and child, because that provide more complete picture of understanding child behavior.
Okay, brilliant. Really super clear. And were the families receiving any intervention during this time? Were they receiving any kind of like therapeutic support, or was it a mixture?
So that we didn't really kind of provide any kind of treatment or therapy. However, we provide some resources if the family kind of like to do that. And then also we have on-site psychologist. So if there is any kind of incident requiring some attention from professional, we have in-staff. And then also for this family, you can see that it is very extensive study. So they usually come around 9 a.m. and we provide some light breakfast. And then they stay for lunch. So we provide also lunch. And then usually it ends like 2 or 3 p.m. And in the beginning, these mothers, so they are bringing infant, right? And also sometimes they have siblings, right? So we have some playroom and lots of fun animation movies for small children. And then also we fed that children too. So it was quite kind of family outing event. And for those women who cannot drive themselves because they don't have a car or it's not easy to use public transportation, then we have contract with a taxi driver we hire. And that taxi driver went to the mother's, the family's house, and then bring them. And then when the assessment done, then that taxi driver drove back. So we provide really good support to really make this study successful and not to lose women. Very good high level of retention rate.
Amazing. What did you find? What were the key findings from the work?
This is quite complex because we have, so you can think about that, those mothers' childhood maltreatment. They recollected, right? But historically, that occurred first. And then mother's drug use during pregnancy. And then we have the mother's report at age 10, when their child was 10, like their mental health symptoms, psychological distress, and there's a parenting behavior, which is a report. And then at age 12, mother reported internalizing symptoms about their child, right? That depressive symptoms and anxiety and psychosomatic symptoms. And there's an externalizing behavior, like acting out behavior, aggressive, disruptive behavior. And then also the child own reported internalizing and externalizing. So we have like four outcome variables here. You can see the mother's childhood maltreatment experience, drug use during pregnancy, and the mental health symptoms, parenting. So we have seven key variables. And also we control for other factors like child gender, and then also, the mother's kind of home caregiving home environment, and then also some kind of socioeconomic status proxy variables. So we control for those things. So what we found is that the mothers, the higher kind of higher level of maltreatment exposure is related to mothers' higher mental symptoms. And that is related to mother-reported child internalizing, externalizing behavior. And also, then how about that those adolescents, the child reported internalizing, externalizing behavior? That was directly related to from mother's childhood maltreatment. So what that means is that regardless of who is providing the information about child behavior problems, there was relationship between mother's childhood maltreatment experience and the child, their own child, offspring behavior problem, right, at age 12. So that's the one finding. The other finding, what our study was very interested in, is that whether the mother who have childhood maltreatment experience is related to prenatal drug use. The relation was somewhat weak, what we call marginal relationship. It's, you know, statistically, it's more than 0.5 value, but there is some link there, right? But it was not significant. But those, the mother's drug use during pregnancy is related to child-reported externalizing, acting out behavior, not internalizing, or not mother-reported internalizing or externalizing behavior. So what this telling us, right? So it looks like the mother's childhood maltreatment experience, that effect going through mother's functioning, obviously, and to affect child behavior problem, regardless who is really talking about their behavior. However, prenatal substance exposure, the mother's substance use during pregnancy, we know that that is kind of somehow change the brain development in utero. So it change functioning of and also structure of the brain. And it may be it more likely to dispose the child brain to be more sensitive to stress. And that is showing at age 12 in our study.
Okay, rightio. That was a great explanation. So could we take those two separate findings and unpack them a little bit? So the first finding, could you give like an example to kind of bring it alive for the listeners around kind of what that would look like from a kind of lived experience perspective?
So we know that like the mother's kind of mental health status is so critical for child development. That's why we really also trying to provide some support to the mothers, right? Especially young children. So one example might be that you can think about, like, if the mother, like, if you don't have good ability to regulate your own emotion, it's very difficult to help child to regulate their own emotion, right? And also when you have a lot of stress, whether it's coming from, I mean, in our study is really about childhood maltreatment history. But when you don't have really good way to regulate and you're still deal with some aftermath effects of childhood maltreatment experience, you may not be able to available emotionally to your child, right? And then also because of that, you tended to use more coercive disciplinary parenting practice, right? And also you are less likely to monitor your child, where they are and who are they are talking to. So that is the really some issues. And then also, you know, mother and child, right? Child learn from mothers, right? The mother usually model how to process and interpret the stressful event, right? And the child, the mother cannot really help child to deal with that because they don't have their own ability to do so. So it is very, I know we don't want to blame mothers, but given the proximity, right, it's really important that mother can really showing that how to regulate some emotional kind of situation, especially during stressful time.
Yeah. And was that consistent across kind of like boys and girls?
That's a very good question. That's one of the areas I'm very, also very interested in that. Kind of can be, I think. It is, I mean, there is a really mixed findings. So sometimes mother tended to, I think also it's kind of cultural differences. Like coming from, I'm from South Korea, the mother maybe treat that boy and girl somewhat differently. And also there may be some innate differences for boys and girls. So, but I think it is kind of similar, but it's very mixed. So one kind of interesting one is that one time our team studies the parental monitoring. So we also ask that parenting monitoring to mother and also children. So the mother answered that, you know, it is kind of question that how I think I monitor to my children, right? For children, how they think that my mother monitor, is that successful or not, right? So when you look at that, those, it's the same question, but it's different informant again about their parents monitoring. And the correlation is around the 0.2. So it's not that strong, but there's some okay correlation. But when we divide it into boys and girls, it's very different. So for boys, the mother's assessment about how I monitor to my son and how that boys think that their mother monitor me, no correlation. No correlation. However, girls, the correlation is around 0.3-ish, I think slightly above 0.3. And that's why we have like half boys, half girls. It combined is around 0.2. So I have two children. I have daughter and son. At the time, it was like they are like 10 and 11. And I thought, oh my God, you know what I think I do to my son? It's nothing what my son think that I'm doing. So, well, you know, guys, that's warning. So when you have son, you may need to be extra careful. So that was kind of interesting. So yes, there is boy and girl some differences. However, I think the studies are somewhat mixed. And also it's complex. You can think about that there is kind of biological hormone differences. And then also the society treat boys and girls differently. Right? You expect more to boys. You expect the boys to be more risk-taking. Go out there, try. But for girls, you are protective. That's why I think that the correlation between the mothers and girls, daughters, correlation is higher because the parents are more, you know, provide more kind of monitoring, high levels of monitoring, right? So, and you worry more about your daughters, you know, than sons. So it's, there is differences in multiple levels, you know, parents and teachers, whether it's good or bad. And because of that, girls are more shy, right, from taking risk, and boys are encouraged to take, so when you think about that accumulation over lifetime, even if the lifetime may be 10 years, 12 years, or 15 years, what can be done? And also maybe there might be some conflict between either side, between what you want versus what parents or teachers or society expect from you. So it is kind of, it's not easy. You think that it can be very simple, but it's not.
Absolutely. I just wondered whether the study opens the door to interventions, whether the kind of like the work that you're doing and particularly that finding kind of like opens the door to kind of opportunities to work with mothers around their own psychological well-being as a kind of like an opportunity to impact on kind of offspring's outcomes.
About how we can help these families. So for me, the social support, I know it sounds very, of course, right? But that's the really key. I really think that because that providing support, and of course, the support can be so many different things. But the social support, if we provide the mothers, so if mother think that I have some social support, think about that. It's something that backup or some safety. You can go back there to ask help, right? And I will be okay, kind of social support, right? So that will really help mother to be a mother they want to be. They can be more calm with their child. They can more engage with their child, and they can also take care of themselves. So I think that kind of social support and like having good network of people who are really, really willing to help provide. And even if it's not realized, just the mother think that I do have that support, right? In emergency, these are the people I can rely on and I'll be okay. And my kid will be okay because of these people. So that core group of people providing social support will be the really key. And having that, and also the other thing is that if mother has a good social support and good social network, right, providing people to mothers, and that also, I think, direct impact benefit to the child because the child will participate that network through mothers. I'm thinking about also, I'm Christian, I go to church every Sunday. The children, my child, they are also taken care of. My church colleagues. And then they make friends through that organization. So that relieves some kind of pressure from parents. And also the child really participate that extended group of people. And that each people may provide some kind of opportunities to model the child and also connected with other resources and opportunities. It really is not just mother, but also to providing that kind of very socially enriched environment to not only to mother, but also child.
Yeah, the power of the community.
Yes, community, yes.
And then I'd like us all to just kind of touch base on the kind of that second finding. So you kind of mentioned about the impact of drug usage on kind of brain development. So could you tell us a little bit more about that?
That's there's a whole field of studying that area. And it's hard area to study because you cannot really test with the humans. So a lot of study is done with animals like rat and even some fly. But what we found is that it kind of changed some brain structure and functioning, especially in relation to stress response. So my study group is more focusing on cocaine. And you can see that this study is kind of secondary data analysis using the data set that collected for the developmental outcome for prenatal cocaine exposure. So what we found that it may not show in the beginning, but there is some really quite good evidence that the prenatal cocaine exposure tended to restrict brain development, meaning that there is really affecting some cognitive development, which can have multiple implications for human development. But also, it really affects some brain functioning that deal with stress response. So what that means, though, is that when you have, you know, in life, there is full of stresses, right? Whether it's small or big, or whether you can deal with or you cannot. But the thing is that your threshold to deal with those stress, your ability, your capability to process and cope with that stress is low. And so that's why it increases vulnerability to psychopathology, exposed to kind of either alcohol or, you know, other types of drug. Can, you know, it's like that. I mean, we are talking about very specifically, but like, because that's such a huge work out there. But what we found in general, it really related to our compromised ability to deal with stress response. So because of that, they are more prone to, right? Every single, even if you are exposed to same level of stress, if somebody is exposed to a prenatal substance, then their ability to deal with stress will be lower. So it increased the vulnerability to mental health problem down the road. And of course, it's not deterministic. I want to emphasize that it's not done there. No, you know, it is like, you have your life. We are talking about what happened when you are in mother's womb. So if you have really good enriched environment, that relationship will be weak. But I mean, think about that. If the woman used cocaine or other drugs during pregnancy, that means that the woman has a problem, right? Substance use problem. How she got there, we don't know. Maybe, but the childhood neglect abuse may be one of big, you know, contributor, right? And also they tended to, come from poor background. So they, their life opportunity may be limited. So they didn't have a chance to really kind of explore and get. But anyhow, that prenatal exposure to substance predispose some vulnerability to those affected child or human being in terms of psychopathology.
Okay. And was that seen in both kind of internalizing and externalizing kind of behavior?
That's a good question. That's excellent question. In our study, it is more related to externalizing behavior, although it's really depending on also what kind of substance. So I think what we found that is, cocaine is more related to externalizing behavior. Alcohol is, I think it can be both internalizing and externalizing behavior. And then for my previous study, we found that tobacco, the smoking, is related to internalizing behavior. And of course, you need to really think about it is also depending on the dosage, right? So how frequently and how much the woman used that dose drug during pregnancy and also when, right? So it's like during 10 months period of pregnancy, that sensitive time might be different. So that is the, and then also even if two children may be exposed to the same amount of, let's say, alcohol or cocaine, maybe it's different how that the child body process that drug will be different, and also how the mother's body process the drug and then also go to the child, it will be different. So there's some kind of a degree of variability and how it really showing up, right? But we know that from multiple studies that there's no safe level for drinking or drug use, drug use, because you don't know how your body and how your child body respond.
Yeah, okay. It's such a complex area. I just kind of like wonder how how do you kind of control for so many kind of variables, kind of like, yeah.
Right. Such a great question. Yes. We're struggling. I think everyone, every researcher is struggling as long as you're working with the human population, right? Unlike rat or mice, you can really control, but for human, you cannot do that. So what we do, you collect the data, that the data that you related to substance use as much as possible. So all those social economic variables and also life event include that childhood maltreatment history and also the child mother relationship and also neighborhood characteristics and like mother's IQ, vocabulary abilities and that neighborhood, how the neighborhood provide, record those, you know, ecological asset, you know, how your peer and your school, you name it. We have so many variables and it is really challenging. I don't want to, you know, undermine that amount of challenge and the amount of effort to try to control and document. So we can really say with some confidence, yes, this is what we found, and it's more likely this is what we think. But that's the what, and it's not just our court. There's kind of multiple study group trying to struggle with that question, and we try to kind of teaching out those confounded and nested, correlated, right, co-influencing factors.
I'm just wondering, you know, did the study uncover any kind of protective factors? Kind of were there any things that kind of like stood out in the research that were kind of protective for kind of better kind of offspring outcomes?
That's very good question. And I think that the field is really heading to that direction. So we have in our study, in our particular study, we collected information about what we call developmental asset. So that developmental asset has two kind of groups. You get two buckets, two categories. One is internal asset. Now you can see a lot of internal, right? It's an internal asset, and the other one is external asset. So internal asset is more like the child own strengths, the self-esteem. You know, this is children. So commitment to learning, positive value, you know, honesty, the positive identity, the future orientation. So that's the internal asset. So it's like own individual's intrinsic strengths. External asset is the ecological asset. So that is kind of related to how my neighborhood or my neighbor think about me. If I am in trouble, do they intervene to help me, you know, that kind of thing. And also my teachers, my school, and my peer, whether my peer is more proactive and pro-social, meaning that they don't drug or they don't, you know, drink. And also my parents, whether my parents spend enough time with me, whether we have dinner together every night or at least couple of nights per week, that kind of thing. So we have that those asset variables, and then how that kind of related to all these kind of bad outcomes, meaning behavior problems, and also we have substance use variables. Yeah, that is. And then also we collected the mother social support. I mentioned that, and that, you know, those mother support, and also a lot of times those protective factors also opposite of the vulnerability. So whether the monitoring, whether you have the parents monitor you in higher level compared to low level. So those things are there, but it's given because of the nature of the research question to start with, which is mother's drug use during pregnancy, it more really focused on that some kind of problems. So, yeah.
And so did you kind of get a sense of there being kind of key moments where kind of like interventions could be kind of most effective? Was there kind of like a sense on that kind of developmental kind of period that you studied? Were there kind of points where there are kind of lots, you know, more opportunities to kind of intervene and change the course?
That's really excellent if we can do, right? So I think I really like to focus on early times so we can, so kind of during pregnancy and also that postpartum, early motherhood, that's the really golden time for us to intervene because that's the time that mothers really also highly motivated to get better for their baby. So that's the time that we can really intervene and to deal with some unfinished business, like, you know, childhood trauma, the mothers, right? And then also substance use problems. And also some psychological, psychiatric, or psychological distress coming from those substance use and also trauma history. And also supporting the mother's parenting skill, right? Because think about that. It's pretty daunting to have a tiny human being with you, right? It is daunting for anyone, but it was daunting for me, right? I'm highly educated with a PhD, but it was daunting. So, I think that's the really a time that we really need to invest. Of course, there's other time point, right? Everybody is ready for that time point. But I think that is the really, for me, a golden time because mothers are more motivated. And also we have, and there was a kind of foundational years for the child. And we already know that nurse visit program for those early, like first, you know, 30 days, just visit to the new mom can be very beneficial and have great outcome. And I think that should be really strengthened and then, but also expanded, especially for these women who used drug during pregnancy and having some challenges, psychosocial challenges.
Yeah, brilliant. I'm just wondering whether you've got any further research kind of like in the pipeline or in these kind of questions in your next projects.
My next project? Oh, I mentioned a lot about support, right? And I think it is really key. And then I think it is key for every human being, but especially when these women's, so especially when they're taking care of our next collective next generation, right? We should help them. So what I like to really kind of do, and also what other people, other researchers who are in this area kind of like to do is that kind of providing some more specification about support. All right. What kind of support? What kind of nature of support, right? And when, to whom, right? So what kind of specific support to what kind of types of families and what time developmentally? So kind of honing, refining the nature of support and timing and also types of family. We have so many different types of family, ethnic differences, and also some families just mother only family, right? And some mothers have great networks, some mothers they don't, right? So honing those specific things will be really help us to prioritize what kind of intervention should be prioritized and what is the really optimal timing to implement such intervention. So I know it sounds very big and vague, but I think that's what we, to do. We have been very good at documenting the negative effects of the childhood history of trauma. And also now we know that it really going to generations, you know, hopefully just can stop, but maybe who knows, right? There is kind of go to second, third, fourth generation, if we don't really provide intervention. And the thing is that child maltreatment, we can prevent, right? You are not born with that culprit. So we can prevent. So we should do. And I think having that kind of support in multiple levels, like interpersonal and also school and educational, right? And neighborhood and community, and of course, policy level in multiple layers to provide the support. I think we can do. Hopefully, we can do. So we can really reduce the number of, maltreatment instance.
Yeah, amazing. It's such an interesting area, such an important area. Is there a place where listeners could go to if they're kind of like wanting to, you know, keep track of your work or kind of like a kind of, is there a collective that are really, you know, a kind of focal point for kind of collecting kind of data and research and influencing the kind of policy area?
Oh, that's good. Question, I don't know. It's I consider myself as a researcher who kind of provide rationale and justification and the direction. But I think there is really kind of multiple agencies and organizations to support to kind of providing services. And then the thing is that there is kind of support for the children who really kind of have some verified evidence, but that can be very late. And then the mother's history of childhood maltreatment, it's not really obvious, right? You don't see that. You only see that some kind of like the mother's behavior, parenting, and we don't know that that certain types of parenting, where it coming from. And it may coming from so many different directions, and that her childhood history may be one of many sources. So it's how we can focus on, it's really kind of providing parenting support for mothers who struggle. And then also an obvious group will be the woman who are using substance, because, and there's a lot of women for that reason, they lose custody. And that is also, then the child go to foster care system. And so all those things are connected. So when I think about those support, maybe it's very difficult to identify the mothers with the childhood maltreatment history. But so you need to really extend the net to provide the support. So those women can be part of the recipient of the services.
Yeah. So we're coming to the end of the podcast. We could keep on talking for ages, I'm sure. I just wonder whether, is there like a final kind of take-home message that you'd like to kind of share?
So the last thing, I want to really emphasize is that if there is anyone kind of know that their mothers use drugs during pregnancy, and I really want to say that that is not deterministic. It can change. Yes, it's not fair. You can overcome. And also mothers who feel sorry about their child because of their lack of ability, it's not their fault. Somehow, society couldn't help you. But you can also change yourself. So hopefully that my talk, it's not really providing some pessimistic negative outlook. Our study also showing that, as you can see, not every woman who experienced childhood trauma used drugs during pregnancy, right? And every woman, any woman, not every woman, we use drugs during pregnancy, their child having problem. So there are just some good things in life that make you turn around. So just trust that force. Sorry that we don't really pinpoint what it was. However, what we suspected is that that will be the social support, right? So that, I think I want to really flip our story, although we are trying to see that the relationship with the child behavior problem, it's not guaranteed. And there is power of not guaranteed. So stick to that piece of the story, and hopefully that this talk provided that kind of different kind of reframing to understand the story.
Thank you for kind of sharing such a heartfelt final reflection. It's been a really great conversation. It's been lovely speaking to you.
Thank you so much for this opportunity. I'm so grateful that my study have additional outlet to public. Thank you so much.
What an incredible closing message from Myeong. It was really touching and inspiring. So I do hope you take a closer look at the paper and her work. It's been a real honor to talk to her today. As always, please leave a comment, a review, a suggestion. Please share these podcasts with your friends and colleagues. And also sign up for the ACAM Learn account. You can get this at www.acamhlearn.org, and you'll be able to get a free CPD CME certificate for listening to any of the podcasts. Next week, we're off to Michigan to speak to Professor Adrian Belts about the Adolescent Brain Cognitive Development Study, known as ABCD, its use and misuse.